I have to ask you, as you watch the Trump presidency unfold, has it stopped being surreal to you?
No, it hasn't. It hasn't stopped being surreal at all. I mean, there are days where I can't believe we're debating whether or not a retweet is an endorsement, or what the president really means when he sends out a GIF of him body slamming a reporter. Should we take that as violent? Is that just a joke? Is that an appropriate joke for the president to make? Why is he calling Kim Jong-un Rocket Man? I mean, it's surreal every single day.
Now, along the way, you, before a lot of people out there, and certainly well ahead of the pollsters, began to sense something, and that maybe the outcome of this would be different than most people expected. What was it you were seeing that led you to believe he could actually win this thing in 16?
You know what? And I think people didn't want to believe it. People who didn't like Donald Trump just refused to acknowledge that he was getting a lot of support, and the rallies were not places that were unusual. They were not anomalies within the electorate. They were extraordinarily enthusiastic, yes. They were completely devoted, yes. They, you know, went out on a limb as Donald Trump would go when he said some of the more outrageous things that he said during the campaign, what was considered to be outrageous, at least. But it wasn't just those folks who went to the rallies that supported him. Whenever I would travel in an airport or in a cab, I mean, I went to, you know, 40 states for this, 500 days on the road. You talk to people, and I would come across just regular folks in cabs, regular folks at diners, regular folks taking, a jet because they're insurance salesmen flying from state to state or whatever it was. And a lot of them would say that they liked Donald Trump. And I got the sense that there were more people out there than the polls were picking up, or that people were not necessarily telling pollsters truthfully how they were going to vote.
Katie, interesting that you mentioned the idea that people were not even willing to honestly share with the relative anonymity of a conversation with a pollster what direction they were leaning in. Was there a particular rally, was there a particular stop along the trail where you recognized that, yeah, not only is this possible, it might even be probable?
You know, I have to say this. He went after John McCain in the summer, July 2015. And John McCain is an American war hero. He's a POW veteran. Donald Trump has never served a day in his life. Usually, in America, denigrating a veteran, denigrating a war hero, a POW, would have been something completely unthinkable, something disgusting to the majority, the vast majority of most Americans. It was not for a number of people with Donald Trump. His poll numbers only went up. And to me, that said, if his poll numbers are going to go up after he blasts somebody like that, something that is usually so sacrosanct, who's to say that he can't get away, I guess, with going after Mexicans or going after women or going after the judicial system or going after the media or going after democracy, going after how we vote, going after literally every system of government that we have in place.
We're talking with Katie Turr. The book is entitled Unbelievable, My Front Row Seat to the Craziest Campaign in American History. And in the book, there's the interplay between you and Trump, which we'll get into later, but also between you and the supporters. And I found it interesting that when you talk to these people, there was almost a disconnect between the way they looked, the way they talked with you, and then the things that they would say, and even the slogans that they would wear on their T-shirts while parading around with wife and kids.
Yeah, and that was what was most surprising, just the level of rhetoric from not the candidate himself, but from the people who did show up to the rallies. Donald Trump was crude, and in this halo of crudeness, the people that supported him were allowed to be crude as well. There was a father with his wife and two young sons saying, you know, Hillary Clinton is a CU something something on his shirt. There was a couple that you could see walking down any street in America and not look twice at. They looked like well-off, stylish polite people screaming at the top of their lungs at a CNN reporter who was sitting next to me at one of the rallies and telling her that she should be putting on more makeup because she needs it, because she's not attractive. And I remember thinking, how is that an acceptable way to conduct yourself, not just in American society, but in any society? But Donald Trump allowed that. You were able to, speak whatever was on your mind, no matter what was on your mind, no matter if it was deeply offensive to somebody else, no matter if it was, frankly, just cruel to somebody else, no matter if it was talking about the violent end to somebody else. At one of the rallies, at the end of the campaign, a man yelled out in the crowd when, at the time, Governor Pence, Hillary Clinton, he yelled out, "Assassinate that B word." He yelled it out, and not a single person in that crowd turned to him and said, "How dare you do that?" Not a single person gave him a sideways glance. This was a man saying, "Assassinate somebody, a political leader in this country, kill somebody." And it was an acceptable thing to say within that space.
We're speaking with Katie Tour. Katie, you referred to the Trump campaign staff as the, quote, bad news bears of politics, the people other candidates didn't pick. How do you take such a literal motley crew as the Trump campaign staff and somehow forge a winner? It seems almost impossible to believe.
Well, you don't credit the crew, you credit the candidate. I mean, the crew did a good job of getting him out and refusing to listen to people who were saying you need to have a red state strategy. They did a good job of fanning him out across the country and taking him to places that nobody thought he should go, places in the upper Midwest like Michigan and Wisconsin and Minnesota, places that Hillary Clinton wasn't going. But ultimately, Donald Trump was what won the race. It wasn't the political crew around him. It wasn't the RNC getting out and supporting him. You could make an argument that they did a really good job with essentially guerrilla marketing, going micro targeting people on Facebook. We still haven't totally understood how they did it and how precise they were and how successful that was with the social media targeting, because obviously there's questions surrounding how this works in these social media companies like Facebook and Twitter. Putting that to the side, Donald Trump was somebody that was, like it or love it, better or worse, was inspiring, I guess, a lot of people. He was making people more enthusiastic about going to vote. He was so bombastic. He was so unwilling to back down, to apologize, that people felt like, you know what, I either like what he's saying, and I like this idea that he's giving this big middle finger to everyone in Washington, or I don't really like him, I'm going to hold my nose, I just feel like something has got to change, and maybe we need to blow up the whole system to do that, and that's why they chose him.
It was such a bizarre campaign, and it became a personal one, as he would call you out at rallies and sometimes attack you and draw attention to you, throw some praise your way once in a while. But the most bizarre episode, I guess we'll just describe as the kiss. It was cringeworthy to read. I can't imagine what it was like to experience. Can you share that story?
You know, it was just an inappropriate thing to do in that, especially in that setting. Donald Trump is not an associate of mine. He is not a friend of mine. He's not a family member. He's not a colleague, a business partner. I wasn't, greeting him at a party in New York or some sort of reception. This was Donald Trump, the candidate for president, going to Morning Joe to talk about his campaign and apparently liking what I had said about him on television. And when he walked in, he walked right up to me and kissed me on the cheek. I'm a reporter. I'm covering your campaign. It in that setting, it was inappropriate, especially because if my bosses saw that, or if my colleagues saw that, or if the average voter saw that, there would be, regardless of whether or not I wanted that to happen, there would be a sense that I was going to report more favorably about him, that we are friends, that we're close, that we get along well, whatever it is. It could color my coverage. It could make people think that my coverage is not as biased or as balanced as it would need to be in this very, very serious situation. I don't know if Donald Trump had any idea that that's the way it would come off. I think he just, in a lot of times, he just doesn't understand the way things work. He's a gut reactor, but I remember feeling in that moment, oh my God, nobody is going to take me seriously.
You also say in the book, and as a teacher, what I do full-time, I love this, you say that you wish journalism could be taught in schools because people don't understand anymore the role of journalism, the notion of having a protective pool of reporters to document history. Why don't people get that anymore?
You know, I think it is a fundamental misunderstanding about what we do, and there's this distrust that's been built up, and it's partially because we've had not all media, but a certain portion of media, right-wing media and right-wing politicians and politicians in general, saying day in and day out for years on end that the media is not to be trusted, that we are all liberal, that we're working for the Democrats, that we're lying to you, or we're only choosing certain stories to cover. That really seeded itself into the psyche of a lot of people in this country. So there was this inherent distrust. But it's also, journalism is something that should make you feel uncomfortable. If we are reporting, it's not, and you feel good about the world or whatever we're reporting on, generally, that means that we're not doing a very good job, generally. Because the news exposes what does not want to be exposed. And I think what we could do to help that is, I mean, we need to build trust with people. They need to know who we are. We need to be out there in the world more rather than just in you know, New York or Washington or the bigger cities. But I think if we started teaching it at elementary school, middle school, high school, here is why journalism is important. Here is what journalists do. Here is how we attribute. Here's how we get sources. Here's how we make sure those sources' identities are protected. Here's how we can confirm that that information is correct. And here are the rules that are in place. And oh, by the way, if we break these rules, it's very likely that we will get fired.
Katie, when you talk about the notion that people struggle understanding the role of journalists today, a lot of that comes from this this weird sort of mashup between entertainment and journalism, and there is an entire group of young people coming up who view that as the journalistic career that they want to attain. How do we go about returning to a level of separation between entertainment and information, or is it hopelessly lost?
You know, that is a really good question, and I certainly hope it's not hopelessly lost. I think we as a society have moved more in the entertainment direction with reality TV, this idea that everybody, you know, everyone's got a phone, everyone's got the ability to have a YouTube channel, they've got Twitter, they've got Instagram, Facebook, they can send video out live. Everybody has the ability to put themselves, accessible to millions of people around the world. Everybody can become a star on their own. And that is fetishized. Being on television can be fetishized. It can seem like it is a very glamorous job. In reality, it's not. And I think anybody who comes into it feeling like, I just want to be on TV, is the further they get into it, the further they realize that it's not something that will make you rich. It's not something that will make you famous. It's just a whole lot of hard work and terrible hours and usually not so pretty locations for days and hours and hours on end. But I think ultimately what we need is for the American public to demand more hard journalism, to subscribe to the New York Times, subscribe to the Washington Post, watch their local news more, and turn away if it's just fluff. You know, you have the power to choose what you want to see with your remote control, with your mouse on your computer. with your dollar at the supermarket. So if you, the American public, decides they want more hard news, we have more resources to give it to you.
Katie, before we let you go, I bring this up because I loved it in the book and I love the show too. For the rest of us, is BoJack Horseman the best possible escape from the land of Trump?
You know, I think so. I think so. Hollywood is a great and weird town. Yeah, you know, any show that has animals in real, I don't even know how to describe it. It's a weird, dark show, but it's great, and it was a wonderful way to escape when I would get back to my hotel room when I needed something, anything other than politics.
The book is absolutely terrific, unbelievable, my front row seat to the craziest campaign in American history. Katie Turr, thank you so much for your work, and thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. I hope the New York City traffic noise wasn't too distracting.